Chapter 8. Goodbye Germ Theory. When we talk about the germ theory, we enter into a realm of historical debate long forgotten in America. To date, there is still no logical basis in science for the germ theory. However, it has become fundamental law with concern to the medical profession and the pharmaceutical companies which support it. In a very real sense, the science of medicine is more like a dogmatic religion, preaching eternal damnation to non-believers and excommunication, in the form of delicensing in jail, for nonconformists. The ultimate demons in this religion are the germs, a group of fiendish opportunists who attack and take advantage of otherwise good and wholesome God-loving folks. You are defenseless against these devils unless you pray with the high priests of medicine, who act as an intermediary between you and God. If you pray with them hard enough, maybe God will help you. Most likely not, however, since the art of praying for a cure with the medical profession statistically looks worse and worse each year. With concern to malignant cancer, the AMA has established 5-year survival rate guidelines for doctors, since that is usually how long the average patient endures before death. It has been shown statistically, however, that if you do not follow medical treatment for a malignant diagnosis, and if you choose to do nothing with your cancer, not even change your style of life and diet, on average, you will live 12 years. This value can obviously be improved past the 12-year mark with proper life changes in diet and detoxification. Far better than your survival odds look while choosing to stay with the standard medical approach of radiation and chemotherapy. Your odds look pretty grim within the medical faith. Thomas Szasz, M.D., has had this to say about the religion of medicine in Reason magazine in June of 1998. Quote, "Using the coercive apparatus of the state to force people to submit to the ministration of doctors of medicine is a persecution in the name of health, exactly as using the coercive apparatus of the state to force people to submit to the ministrations of doctors of divinity was persecution in the name of God." Unquote. The idea of entities called germs maybe causing disease predates Louis Pasteur by several centuries. However, in 1878, Louis Pasteur was credited with the full tenets of the germ theory, solidifying all its laws and postulates which are used this very day in the determination of disease. History paints a much better picture of Pasteur than reality dictates, as he is credited with solving the mystery of fermentation, the silkworm disease in France, the rabies dilemma of his time, as well as being able to control the spread of anthrax through his vaccine. Hey, after all, it's been on TV. It must have happened that way. Who was Louis Pasteur, really? He was a chemist. He had no formal training in biology, as the story dictates. The discovery of fermentation did not belong to Pasteur alone. The silkworm cure that he instituted cut the production of silk in France by half. More people got sick and died from his rabies vaccine than ever had rabies to begin with during his time. In 1956, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, reported that the Academy of Medicine in France found Pasteur's rabies vaccinations may be followed as much as 20 years later with a rare form of psychosis. This, at the very least, shows the AMA acknowledged at some point in time that vaccines can cause health problems decades later. It has been shown statistically that in countries where the Pasteur rabies vaccine has been employed, the number of deaths from hydrophobia, rabies, has actually increased and not diminished. Pasteur's anthrax vaccine in Russia was nothing short of a disaster. 4,500 sheep were administered the vaccine, and 3,600 dropped dead almost immediately following. Pasteur's rabies vaccine killed King Alexander of Greece, who was given the treatment after being bitten by a monkey. He died within 1 week of the vaccine. These are all the wonderful Pasteurian facts you've never heard in school. What really happened around 1878? Well, it turns out that the real credit for most of Pasteur's success belonged to a man named Pierre Bichamp. He was a French scientist contemporary to Pasteur, who for some reason not fully acknowledged, made all the discoveries given claim to Pasteur well before they became common knowledge. Pasteur and Bichamp may have had some form of working agreement that was never known to historians, but it is said in some historical circles that Pasteur actually plagiarized most of Bichamp's hard work. Bichamp was known as a quiet, humble man that did not like the limelight. Bichamp continued to pursue his work quietly as Pasteur became more popular with most of Bichamp's earliest discoveries, including fermentation. Bichamp's work was based on the observation of live tissues, as opposed to dead tissue samples of lab work today. In these live tissues, he saw tiny bodies he called microzyma. He then went on to propose publicly that these microzyma were the basic unit of life, indestructible, immutable, and eternal. He found these bodies in both plant and animal tissue. He found them in both healthy and diseased tissue. In healthy tissue, he found them to be normal, constructive parts of the growing metabolism of the cell. In unhealthy tissue, he discovered that they evolved into bacteria. By this time, Pasteur was off on his own, running with his recreation of the germ theory. He did not realize what Bichamp had realized, that the medium determines whether or not microorganisms such as bacteria are present. Bichamp saw clearly that bacteria are endogenous, that is, they come from within us, from within our own tissues and cells, from some basic point of life, in which he called microzyma. The important difference here is that Bichamp realized bacteria and other microbes are formed out of necessity by the body itself. They do not come from some outside attacking mode of virulence. It's too bad that Pasteur, who was best at promoting himself, did not catch on to this theory of the microzyma, for if he did, things would be a lot better today for it. Bichamp carried on some fantastic experiments that never made it to the history books. All of his work confirmed his belief in the presence of microzyma, that all bacteria originate from them, and that bacteria are pleomorphic, able to change shape upon the need of the tissue. Pasteur, on the other hand, claimed that bacteria are monomorphic, only one shape per strain, or species, of bacteria, and that they originate from outside the body in nature. Pasteur postulated that there is one bacteria or other microbe for each disease. This microbe is the causative agent of the disease, and you will find it in every sick tissue of that diseased person or animal. Bichamp obtained the carcass of a kitten and embedded it in calcium carbonate, chalk, for approximately 8 years. He took special care to prepare the carcass aseptically, which means no germs could possibly get in through the outside world. Upon examination of the carcass after this 8-year period, as would be suspected, he found it primarily decomposed. He repeated this experiment again, only this time he removed all the dead internal organs, treated them separately with another aseptic process, and examined the organs and the skeleton separately after a shorter period of years. He found identical results. In both cases, there were varying forms of bacteria with abundant microzyma. Other scientists became intrigued with Bichamp's work and decided to repeat the process for themselves. Internal organs were taken from varying dead animals. The external portions of the organs were then treated aseptically, usually with an alcohol base or other antiseptic, bactericidal fluid. This was to ensure that no external microbes could affect the experiment. Some of these organs were even left suspended in a constant stream of bactericide. In all cases, it was found that where the antiseptic fluid could not reach, endogenous microbial activity flourished. How did these microbes get inside the organ? A doctor today may tell you that, of course, certain strains of bacteria and microbes are endogenous. They sit inside our body, in all our organs, waiting to take advantage of the medium when its resistance is low, or in this case, quite dead, to take over and ingest the now morbid organic matter. The medical profession is mostly correct with this fact, but they miss one subtle and very vital point. The microbes, such as the different strains of bacteria, are not there as evil opportunists, hidden time bombs just waiting in the shadows to take advantage of our low resistance. They are actually created out of our necessity, following the commands of the organic web of life. They spring forth within each cell upon the need. In a living person, they spring forth to eat poisonous organic material, with the most common form being that of foreign or excess proteins, in an effort to cleanse the system. If there is an abundance of toxicity, especially in the form of proteins, either from vaccines or poor dietary habits, they will be created in abundance. Their respiratory, metabolic, and excretory processes, breathing, eating, and going to the bathroom processes, just like you and I, can then make the surrounding body tissue sore. This is when we go to the medical doctor. He takes a culture of our throat and tells us we have a bacterial infestation. Here, take these antibiotics. This is as smart as blaming rats for the garbage pileups that occur during a sanitation worker strike. The rats are just there doing their job. They eat garbage, and if you don't want to see them around your neighborhood anymore, well then, clean up the garbage. Spraying rat poison on the garbage pileups is only a temporary solution, and one that has serious side effects to the greater good of your neighborhood. Taking antibiotics for this kind of bacterial infection is the same bad idea. The bacteria did not create your sickness, nor did the virus, the yeast, or any other natural microbe you can name, save the ones created by government genetic experiments to actually cause havoc with living tissue. You are sick because you are having a sick system, either physically, emotionally, spiritual, or some combination of the three. The microbes that arise from your cells, quite possibly through Bichamp's microzyma, are members of the web of life called saprophytes. These are defined as a group of microorganisms whose sole existence is designed by God to break down dead, diseased, and/or dying organic material into its simpler forms of organic chemicals. The biblical ashes to ashes and dust to dust scenario. Nothing in the web of life is ever wasted. When physical matter becomes devoid of life force, i.e., when you leave your physical body at the time of so-called death, the organic materials which comprise the physical form are broken down and thus return to the earth from whence they arose. The physical form cannot survive without the spirit, life force energy which animates it through the nervous system. It is simply a vehicle for this energy, which, as Einstein stated, can never be created nor destroyed. Now consider a smaller version of total physical death. Simple cellular death, which occurs thousands of times each second with the rebirth of new, healthy body cells. In a totally fit and healthy individual, white blood cells of the immune system find it easy to handle the job of cleaning up these dead cells with some help from indigenously created microbes like bacteria. This is precisely why, healthy or not, a throat culture will always show some bacterial activity. Microbes are never absent from your body. They are a ubiquitous form and fact of life. But most people are not so healthy, since most people do not exercise healthy habits physically, emotionally, and spiritually. To the direct proportional degree that we do not exercise healthy habits, we have a proportional level of increased cellular death. When the white blood cells and antibodies of the immune system cannot handle the load of this increased cellular cleanup, microbes are created, indigenously, as extra workers for the process. Pasteur, being the chemist that he was, saw this connection, which he most likely acquired from Bichamp, that bacteria and other microbes carry out chemical processes within the body. He also noticed that these chemical processes have to do with microbial respiration, metabolism, and excretion. Pasteur's difference, however, was in his lack of vision. The party line during his time was demanding a culprit enemy for the high level of disease in certain areas of the globe, and Pasteur was determined to give them one. Microbes, due to Pasteur, then became the phantom ghosts of disease, a new enemy to wage war on, taking the responsibility, once again, off the people. In this case, it meant the responsibility of providing sanitary living conditions, both externally and internally. As an example, during the time of the so-called bubonic plague, the living conditions in France and most areas of Europe were far from ideal for the bulk of citizens. There was no sanitation in larger, more congested areas of city life, where people crammed together in small living quarters would dump their feces and urine onto the streets. The most popular food of the average commoner was lard pie. You read that correctly. That's the same as fat pie. These fat pies were usually mixed with potatoes and other heavy starches. Another contribution to the generalized poisoning of Europe at that time was cooking with lead utensils. You can only imagine how a diet of this nature, prepared with lead utensils, would clog up the circulatory system with accumulated fat and poisons. Was there any doubt that these people would develop large, painful bubose glands? Hence the bubonic plague. The treatment for the bubonic plague was similar to the intent of modern-day chemotherapy, i.e., cut out what appears to be the bad parts. Some people had their glands removed from their armpits and groin. Now, as you are most likely aware, the glands of the body belong to the lymphatic system. This system cleanses the blood with the glands around the neck, armpit, and groin acting as filters. These people lived in highly toxic circumstances most of their lives, and now their swollen and overworked blood filters were being removed. Not too smart, but then again, it's medicine. Medical philosophy has not changed much in 500 years, centering itself around either cutting something out or drugging something out. The party line on the bubonic plague, which is hysterically still taught as such, is that rats carried fleas which carried microbes that created the disease. That is total nonsense. External sanitation improved by leaps and bounds in the turn of the 20th century. This is why all statistical research shows major infectious disease rates declining rapidly around 1910. But the war on germs was seen to be a worthwhile one, most likely due to a mixture of human superstition and greed. Out of this war was born the oppressive medical cartel we are all struggling with today. It's time we educate the people as to the truth and real purpose of these microbes and end this fictional war. It is high time to say goodbye, germ theory. The Bishop experiment was reproduced many times by many scientists through the early 1900s. Upon the advancement of laboratory procedure, isolated tissues were used instead of entire organs, suspended in aseptic fluid. The same results were produced time and time again. On the outside of the tissue that had been in contact with the aseptic material, there were obviously no microbes. There were microbes, as before, within all the more internal cells that did not contact the fluid. Finally, around the turn of the 20th century, there were some interesting technological advances, which gave birth to the work of another brilliant American scientist named Raymond Rife. In the 1920s, Rife postulated that there was something he was not seeing when he looked at cellular materials under the common compound microscope of his time. He brilliantly theorized that the reason he could not see everything one could see when viewing living tissue under a microscope was because of the lack of ultraviolet light, in which the common microscope's lenses could not detect. The glass of a common microscope does not allow UV radiation to enter the field of view. Rife then built a series of amazing microscopes that still to this day are second to none. For example, all of his lenses were made of quartz crystal and not glass. This allowed the full range of UV light to come into the scope's field of view. He then began to see another realm of existence. Rife also came up with a system of magnification that rivaled early electron microscopes of our day, about 150,000 times magnification. He viewed all kinds of tissue with his new scopes, live and dead, found Bishop's microzyma everywhere. When viewing these microzyma with the quartz scope under higher and higher magnification, he found smaller and smaller units of microzyma. Like Bishop, Rife discovered that these small units of life spontaneously evolved into varying forms of larger microorganisms, solely dependent on the type of tissue in which they existed, healthy or toxic. Amazingly enough, he completed experiments where, through carefully controlling the level of toxicity within any given tissue, he was able to have the microzyma evolve into a viral type of organism that created cancer in the tissue every time. This, of course, indicated an intimate connection between cellular toxicity and cancer. From this place, he attempted to work on a cure for cancer by reversing the process. These experiments were not successful. However, Rife continued his work to the discovery of healing EMF, electromagnetic fields. He built a device which created EMFs that could disintegrate certain viral substances from a distance. Reif was a truly brilliant man, unfortunately lost to history on purpose through the actions of the medical cartel. The Journal for the Franklin Institute in Pennsylvania wrote an article about Reif's work in 1944. The title of the article was "The New Microscopes." Quote, Reif showed that by altering the environmental and food supply, friendly germs, such as colon bacillus, can be converted into pathogenic germs, such as typhoid, and that this process is reversible. Experiments in the Reif lab established that the virus of cancer, like viruses from other diseases, can easily be changed from one to another by means of altering the media upon which they feed. With the first change of the media, the cancer virus becomes enlarged, looking very much like E. coli. Observation under an ordinary scope is made possible through a second alteration in media. A third change is undergone upon an asparagus-based media, where the cancer virus is now transformed from its filterable state into Cryptomyces pleomorphia fungi. Unquote. This is a very important article to the nature of our discussion. Reif was able to show from this experiment that took place in the 1940s that he could take the virus that created cancer in his lab animals and turn it into E. coli, the friendly colon bacillus, and then into a fungus. This fits in well with the basic premise of our text. These microbes are saprophytes, producing primarily for breaking down matter into its constituent elements. This is precisely what they do when you get sick. They are not attacking you. Indeed, they are attempting to help bring you back to better health and wholeness. By removing the diseased, toxic cellular material from your tissues, you are better able to create new, healthy cells to heal the tissue. The nature of disease is not germs. The true nature of disease is the toxic input you place into your body, or randomly run across in your drinking water from pollution or radiation, and your body's quest to eliminate it. We said before that so-called germs are ubiquitous. They are ever-present in many varying forms in both healthy and sick people. These microbes kick into what modern scientists call pathogens when the media is toxic and conducive to clean up. When you enter into a healing crisis and your body is throwing off toxins, these germs appear out of your very substance to help eliminate, process, and break down these toxins. Germs have absolutely no causal relationship to disease, but germs do appear to help you clean out, because, put quite simply, modern medical professionals have made a very false, yet understandable assumption that germs create disease due to their mere presence in sick people. This is a vast oversimplification of the real process, however, and it is high time to end it. Reif's work is actually preceded by another great study completed by Dr. H. Rosenau at the Mayo Biological Laboratory in 1910. He did the reverse process of Reif, who showed you can turn bacteria into different forms by altering their environment. Rosenau took a myriad of disease germs and placed them in the same media and found that over time they all transformed into the same microorganism. Rational bacteriology is a milestone, yet out of print text of microbiology. It was independently published in 1953 by three doctors, Werner, Vaillant, and Watkins. This text confirms Bichamp's work and speaks of the actual basis of bacteriology that is not Pasteurian propaganda. It cites countless experiments hidden from the public which prove that microorganisms like bacteria are formed from granules, which are inherent as a healthy constituent of every living cell. When these granules morph into bacteria, they do so to actually boost immunity and aid in the healing process. Staphylococci bacteria were found to be a primary force involved in the production of white blood cells for immunity against varying poisons, as well as generalized blood clotting. This truth is miles away from the Pasteurian nonsense we were all led to believe in school, that these bad germs are single-minded opportunists that work for your persistent demise. Nothing could be further from the truth. They are part of the body's defense mechanism to clean house and purify the system back to homeostasis. balance. They exist in this granular form until needed. When are they needed? When your body has reached a certain limit of toxicity from your external environment, or more likely, your dietary and drinking habits. What does the medical establishment say to do once they detect these bacterial healing agents? Wipe them out with antibiotics, translation is against life, and other toxic drugs, and further turn your internal body fluids into a toxic soup. This germ theory of the Dark Ages is nothing but a deliberate mass insanity pushed upon society to gain profit and power. By acting against microbes as the medical establishment dictates, one is actually helping to dig one's own grave, while paying someone else to show where to dig. This insanity must end. Rational bacteriology states, quote, extensive studies of bacteria show definitely that there are no fixed species. A cocci can become a bacilli, a spirilli, and vice versa. Streptococci and pneumococci interchange. All bacteria either acquire or lose virulence, depending upon their environment. Bacteria change to molds and vice versa in response to adequate environmental stimuli. Furthermore, they can resolve into their smallest form, a submicroscopic granule, Bichamp's microzyma. The bacterial toxins, which were once thought to be entirely free of particles, are not really homogeneous solutions at all, but actually contain the tiny granular stages of bacteria which broke down to form them. Unquote. The largest problem I have discovered with presenting such evidence in today's modern scientific world is that professionals say, so what if all this is true? They can transform all they like. And who cares about microzyma? Germs still cause disease. Studies are not done on the correlation of germs to disease anymore, because the scientific community answers that germs create disease without question. This is similar to the witch hunts of old, where everyone was certain there were witches running about, and if you were a non-believer, perhaps you should be burned at the stake as well. Any work challenging the correlation of germs to any disease is simply not supported, and due to finances, simply viewed as a waste of time and money. What pharmaceutical company do you know that will fund a study to prove that germs have no correlation with the creation of disease? Bichamp's findings can easily be reproduced today, but no one wants to reproduce them. The medical cartel has suppressed any information available on such discoveries, and financially discourages medical professionals from inquiring further to study into microzyma. Since virtually no one on Earth knows of this information today, it can be said that they have been immensely successful in their suppression of the truth. Party line number 11. Koch's postulates are the indisputable proof that germs cause disease. They are the foundation stone of proof for the germ theory. Junior doctors-to-be and medical professionals from most health professions learn this party line about Koch's postulates. It is perhaps one of the most embarrassing facts of so-called modern science that these postulates prevail as the foundation stone for medical diagnosis. The postulates in and of themselves are not invalid. They are quite scientific. However, what we are not told is that not one single disease of recorded history can be explained by using them as a guideline. Not one. If anything, Koch's postulates can be very effective in proving just the opposite, that so-called germs have absolutely nothing to do with the creation of disease. With concern to any given disease process, any high school biology student could adequately dispute any of these postulates with mere common biological knowledge. These postulates come to us from the famous German bacteriologist Robert Koch, who won a Nobel Prize for their development in 1905. For the purpose of saying goodbye to the germ theory, let's consider them in some detail. Koch's postulates. 1. In order for a germ to cause disease, the germ has to be found in every case of the disease. 2. In order for a germ to cause disease, it can never be found apart from the disease. 3. In order for a germ to cause disease, it must be capable of disease culture outside the body. 4. In order for a germ to cause disease, it must be capable of producing by injection the same disease as that undergone by the body from which it was taken. The basis of vaccines. Any honest mainstream bacteriologist will tell you each of these postulates are completely fictitious with concern to the correlation of germs and disease. Let's take each one separately. 1. Found in every case of the disease. Hey, you mean just like AIDS? HIV is proven to be doing absolutely nothing in healthy people, and again, thousands of medically diagnosed AIDS cases have showed up with no trace of HIV. See Chapter 7. It is historical fact that you can go through case after case after case, finding people being diagnosed with various diseases while being unable to locate the germ. Where's the germ? How do medical professionals find many of these germs anyway? Through antibody tests that don't mean anything, and as we have discussed, are highly unreliable. Even if a specific pathogen is found in a sick person, there is no way to prove a solid causal relationship. A 1993 national television special featured What is the Real Cause of AIDS? This program told the truth in a way I've never seen before on mainstream television, and I recommend the powers that be who delivered this information to the public nationally. It is only through the efforts of good people like these in the know that the public can be saved from the parasitic nature of the medical cartel. It is because of efforts like this one to expose medical fraud that we as a nation of people were saved from a massive AIDS epidemic scam masterminded by the CDC and EIS. For more information on the EIS, please see next chapter. I would like to take some time here, in consideration of this first postulate, to reproduce some quotes from that show, since they are most relevant to our discussion. The show began by stating that HIV and AIDS have no proven correlation. It then switched to the man with the deep pockets in the AIDS establishment, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci had this to say, quote, "What's next is to develop an appropriate, safe, and effective therapy and a safe and effective vaccine. That's the bottom line of it. You have a disease, you have the cause, you identify a treatment, and you get a vaccine for it." Unquote. Find the bug, study the bug, kill the bug, teach your body how to kill the bug. This guy is a standard medical cartel employee. I have a list in my possession of the 1991 membership of the EIS, and guess what? It shouldn't surprise you that Dr. Anthony Fauci is a member. Dr. Robert Gallo, probably one of the loudest mouths of government and AIDS establishment screaming that HIV causes AIDS, is also a member. It shouldn't surprise you that none of the other doctors quoted here, who stated just the opposite of Drs. Fauci and Gallo, are members. Dr. Luc Montagnier was the first to isolate and study HIV in Europe. He had this to say, quote, "I think people should really think and perhaps try to have new concepts, because AIDS is a complicated disease and not caused only by HIV." Unquote. Dr. Walter Gilbert, a Nobel Prize winner in microbiology at Harvard University, had this to say, quote, "The major thing that concerns me by calling HIV the cause of AIDS is that we do not have proof of causation. This is a major reason to be concerned. The crucial parts of this argument are that all cases of AIDS are not associated with the virus, and there is an inference made that all people with the virus will ultimately come down with AIDS. This is, of course, not known to be a fact." Unquote. The interviewer asked Dr. Joseph Sonnabend, a private AIDS researcher and clinician, that if HIV does not cause AIDS, why does it say it does in popular medical texts of microbiology that medical students learn from? The doctor answered, quote, "It is most definitely not a fact that HIV causes AIDS. That is a conjecture and not an established fact. The harm in the whole notion of speculation presented as fact, such as this one, is that if the speculation proves to be untrue in the long run, this means that research and work on whatever is truly going on has been neglected. This, of course, with a disease like AIDS, can be translated into the loss of tens of thousands of lives." Unquote. Dr. Robert Root Bernstein is a physiologist at Michigan State University and author of the book Rethinking AIDS. He had this to say, Quote, "When I look at AIDS patients, I can find that no one who develops AIDS that does not have a multitude of immunosuppressant agents working on them simultaneously. The logic of the war on AIDS is seriously flawed." Unquote. The interviewer asked Robert Root Bernstein what would happen if you injected or otherwise exposed a totally healthy person to the HIV virus. He answered, quote, "Actually, you wouldn't need to propose an experiment such as this. It has already been done. There are people who are married to blood transfusion patients, people who are married to hemophiliacs, who have been exposed to HIV from these means. There are surgeons who cut themselves all the time while working on AIDS patients, and these people are free of HIV. Even more interesting are the several dozen cases in the medical records where people have demonstrated that healthy individuals with no other known risks have developed an infection through one of these routes. They can show HIV was in their bloodstream, and that it infected some of their cells, and they developed antibodies to it, and that, at a later time, they could no longer find any HIV. In some cases, these people even lost their antibodies to HIV, and all have remained perfectly healthy." Unquote. Dr. Anthony Fauci had a scripted answer to these doctors. Quote, "There can be a long process that it takes for the immune system to go down after an injection with HIV. People are very different. Some people have a response to the virus that the immune decline is very rapid. Some people take a longer period of time to get sick." Unquote. Doesn't this mean that the real cause of AIDS are those factors which cause one person to have a rapid decline and others to have a slow decline? Dr. Fauci simply routs the medical party line that if infected, you must be sick at some time, and therefore, you are sick now. This is like saying that because I burned myself with the iron last Tuesday, next time I use the iron, I will again burn myself. Dr. Fauci's statements on the show were nothing short of an admission that HIV has no scientific correlation to AIDS. Dr. Peter Duesberg is a hero for the people regarding this AIDS epidemic fraud. He is a pioneering virologist at the University of California at Berkeley, and has for years been the loudest voice stating that HIV and AIDS have nothing to do with one another. He said, quote, "I would drink HIV-infested water all day long. There would be absolutely no risk in doing so. There is no proof that HIV causes AIDS. In addition, I am familiar with retroviruses, how they behave and what they do. And on those counts, I am confident enough that HIV, no matter how, couldn't possibly cause AIDS. Because of this view, my funding for viral research was not renewed. But there is a growing number of people who are asking questions. Another thing is that this is just the tip of the iceberg. Many people who have doubts that I know of tell me they can't afford to speak up now because their research plans and grant money depend on HIV. If I join you, my grants will be terminated just like yours." Unquote. The interviewer asked Dr. Root Bernstein the following. Quote, "I have a grant to look at something which you and I both agree is silly, but neither of us are going to say anything about it, since it's primarily about receiving the money." Unquote. Dr. Root Bernstein responded, quote, "To put it bluntly, that is a good statement, yes." Unquote. Despite everything you've just read, Dr. Fauci still stated, quote, "Certainly the amount of funding to HIV is clearly greater than the funding going into other areas, and for very logical reasons. The logical reason is that if you don't have the virus, you don't get sick." Unquote. Dr. Fauci seriously needs to step out of his office at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and read what the research proves. HIV clearly contradicts all of Koch's postulates and cannot possibly be a prime causative factor in the development of AIDS. By chasing HIV, Dr. Fauci and the government have spent over $4 billion in HIV research. A very small percentage is devoted to studying other factors besides HIV. The amount of funding for research that examines if HIV has nothing to do with AIDS is 0%. So well over $4 billion has been spent on examining an AIDS culprit that doesn't hurt any cells, and that when it supposedly kills someone, you are unable to locate it. It is the hallmark of a poorly positioned hypothesis that it produces no results in research, and HIV research is the poster example of such a dilemma. Dr. Walter Gilbert remembered when EIS attempted to make cancer an infectious disease caused by a virus. He said, quote, "This comes out of a disappointed war on cancer. This is the political force which has turned into the war on HIV and AIDS. By pointing to a viral causation, you can attempt to promise the people that science would do something about it in the short run." Unquote. This is a very nice way to view the situation. It assumes that at least the government is trying to find answers for the people. The truth is, however, that the medical cartel has promulgated the AIDS epidemic for profit, and that is a statement very few people are willing to admit, but I surmise many agree with. Continuing on with our discussion of Koch's postulates. Number 2. Never found apart from the disease. Another laugh. In a relatively short time after Koch came up with this postulate, it was realized to be an immense error with concern to microorganisms. During any study on any day of the year, it can be shown that healthy people are teeming with varying forms of bacteria, viruses, yeast, and fungi for many communicable diseases. How come these people are without symptoms and otherwise healthy? Number 3. Capable of culture outside the body. Guess what? Any medical professional knows you cannot grow bacteria or virus on healthy tissue. When you attempt to grow an AIDS culture of HIV virus on healthy tissue, the T lymphocyte count, major white blood cell, does not get damaged. In fact, it shoots up. Isn't the AIDS virus supposed to destroy blood cells upon contact? A researcher will never be able to grow bacteria or viruses on healthy tissue. Of course, you can culture any kind of bacteria or any other microbe outside the body. But what are you using to do such a thing? Beef broth. Albumin-based broth. Eggs. What do all these things have in common? They're all dead. They're all morbid organic matter. Just the food sacrifice love. Microbes look for this morbid organic matter in your body as well. Number 4. Capable of producing by injection the same disease as that undergone by the body from which it was taken. In February of 1921, a U.S. government bulletin reported that the hygienic laboratory study, where they tried in every possible way to contaminate 62 Navy personnel with influenza. They took sputum from influenza cases and sprayed it down their throats. Yuck. They sprayed the same on their foods. They kept these people in constant contact with influenza patients. The conclusion of the study showed no appreciable reactions. Don't we all experience aspects of this study on a daily basis? How many people do you come into contact with in which you don't catch anything from? Why is it that many people don't get the flu each year? How come what they do is not studied? These are very good questions that we must push our lawmakers to take seriously.